You're listening to a Castaway Media podcast. Find more great shows on our website, castaway.media.
Welcome to the very first episode of Bookish, a podcast about books with me, Shane Breslin of Blackbird Books in Navan, open since April and still proudly Ireland's newest independent bookshop.
And my name is Bob Johnston, owner of the Gutter Book Shop in Temple Bar and Dalkey, presumably now second oldest, newest independent bookshop. You're very welcome.
Over the course of this and every podcast, we'll be talking news, views and controversies in the world of books. In Trilogy, our guest slot, we'll find out three influential books in the lives of our special guest. This month, we meet one of Ireland's leading crime writers, Arlene Hunt. Also on the show, we'll be letting you know our book club choice to be discussed in more depth with me and Bob next month. Second Look is our pick of a book that we, or one of us at any rate, think may have been a bit overlooked first time around. And we round off the show with a roundup of new books hitting the shelves over the next few weeks, which are getting us excited.
So, kicking off, we like to kick off every episode with a bit of news and a bit of a catch-up of everything that's going on in the book world as we see it. So there's various stories that have caught our eyes this month. Shane, what's been going on for you?
I suppose the first one, and for our first show, it's good to look back at one of the big news stories of the summer in Ireland, in books in Ireland at any rate, and that's the great book reviewing controversy of 2015.
Fantastic.
This one really hit the headlines or grabbed the spotlight in the middle of July when one of the most eagerly awaited books of the year, The Mark and the Void by Paul Murray, was segmented, to say it diplomatically.
politely segmented, yes.
In the pages of the Irish Times by Eileen Battersby. What did you make of this, Bob?
It's an odd one, isn't it? Should you give a book a bad review if you really don't like it? Well, yeah, of course you should. You know, if you hate something, you're being paid to review a book. Not every review can be glowing. I remember reading that review in the Irish Times on the Saturday that it came out and being shocked. Because, A, it's so rare to read in the Irish press a review that absolutely destroys a book. And she did, and she destroyed that book. But at the same time, if you can't review a book fairly, should you be reviewing it at all? I've had conversations with various people about reviewing and how they review. And we all know the Irish book industry is quite small. We all meet up at parties. We all go here, there and the other. All the writers know each other. They're likely to bump into each other at festivals, that kind of things. So there is a bit of this could be an awkward situation. I haven't read The Mark and the Void yet. I keep meaning to come to it. I've heard from other people, it's not that bad. It's not his most amazing book, but it's pretty good. So did it reserve a bad review?
It was, and the review itself was, it felt a little over the top, I think, is maybe one of the a polite way of putting it. Just to read a couple of the lines which were in the review. There are so many false notes that the best way to explain this novel is to compare it to a piano held together with thread. So thin on comedy that even the most daring stand-ups tend to look elsewhere for material, if only Paul Murray had done the same. Tedious, laboured, self-conscious, the gags come ready-made and dead on arrival. Bloated and complacent, the sloppily written narrative meanders along, late in the narrative by which time I was ready to scrub the barn with a toothbrush.
I would say the barn with the toothbrush line is the one that stayed in my subconscious, I think.
I thought that was a great line.
It is a good line. In fairness, it was, as bad reviews go, it was a well-written bad review. But
I have read The Mark and the Void, and I think definitely Eileen, the tone of Eileen's piece was very strong. I wouldn't necessarily disagree with a huge amount of what she had to say. I guess it was a disappointing book for me, and probably it was disappointing because I went into it with expectations that were so high.
Well, this is what I wondered, because Eileen Battersby loved Skippy Dies, Paul's previous novel, and she obviously was eagerly awaiting this one. So if you're let down like that, Your sense of disappointment perhaps influences the way you review that book on its own. And should you review a book on its own or as part of a body of work? You know, if John Banville chucked out an awful novel, should it be stated or should it say, oh, it's a bum note in an opera of wonderfulness? You know, it's a hard one to call. I personally do some reviewing, but would I give a bad review? I would probably actually pass it to somebody else if I didn't feel I could give it a good review.
I think so. And it was interesting. The week after the newspaper, the Irish Times kind of had a follow-up piece where they asked loads of people to weigh in on the debate. And it was interesting. John Boyne had some interesting things to say. He wrote a really bad review of... And I can't recall who he wrote a bad review of last year, but he's said he's not doing it anymore because he regretted it instantly, and he's saying that if he doesn't like a book, he's not going to review it. Certainly an Irish book. Carlo Gebler said never review a book you hate, return it. Peter Murphy said he tries to avoid reviewing writers he's likely to run into on the campaign trail, and that's going to be impossible in Ireland because it's so small. So I guess it asks questions about what a review should be. And I know there are differences, I guess, between a review versus a critique versus a criticism, and reviews are maybe a little less deep than a piece, a work of literary criticism. But it's a really, really hard thing because the pool is so shallow in Ireland of the number of people. They are always going to meet each other, and part of me admires Eileen Battersby for kind of putting her head on the block a little bit, and I think we're all better served by honest reviews, I think.
In other news, there's a couple of other pieces that have come up there this month that have caught our eyes. Everyone's talking about Anne O'Loughlin at the moment. She's just published her first novel, The Ballroom Cafe, which has instantly gone into the Amazon charts, in the top 20 there. Relatively unknown and a big bestseller, or so we believe.
Yeah, she's sharing in top 20. She's sharing place in there with the likes of E.L. James. It's been, I think it's only about 3 months old. I think it was published in June. It's published by a small. I'm saying small. I haven't heard of them. They may well be a little bit bigger.
No, they weren't a publisher I was aware of.
Yeah, but I think Black and White Publishing. I think it's called. It's a Scottish publisher. I think it's been driven by ebook sales in a lot of cases, so it's been driven by Kindle, and I think it's available very cheaply on Amazon as well. I think it's around about the euro mark or maybe less than that. I think it's about 150,000 sales so far, so that propels you into the upper echelons, and I'm sure being included in lists like this will only garner further sales a little bit down the line.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? How do you make a bestseller in the big new market? You price it incredibly cheaply, get it out there and get people talking about it. And, you know, there's a lot of writers out there who put their work up for free or for 50 cent or whatever, but don't garner this kind of publicity. So perhaps this is actually somebody working the system to their advantage. You know, you use a cheap inner offer to get a few people, you know, or get a lot of people buying it first off, and then you get all the publicity from that, and then use that to sell copies of the book at a full price, you know. So it's quite a clever little plan. I mean, I don't know much about the Ballroom Cafe. I believe she used to work for the Irish Daily Mail.
She's a journalist of 30 years experience. She works currently with the Irish Examiner, I think. Oh, okay. She's based in Wicklow. And I've read the sample. That's as far as I've gone with the Ballroom Cafe, and it's as these things are. It's well written and well put together. It is very much in the, how would you say it, popular fiction genre or that segment, but a lot better written maybe than some others that I would have seen there. And I think it definitely has clearly hit a chord with plenty of readers. And best of luck to Anne O'Loughlin. I'm sure she may go to bigger and better things over time.
The other thing we were talking about the caught our eye that sounds intriguing is this idea of readers ride for free. What was this about?
Yes, this was in Romania. I believe it was over the last, it was a month or two ago, and it was just for a week, I think. But the travellers on public transport were given free tickets on the buses in the Romanian city of Cluj-Napoca, I think it is. It's not one I'm overly familiar with, but really interesting concept. The man behind it, Victor Miron, wrote a piece on Board Panda on the web. And one of the interesting things I think he had to say was it's better to promote reading by rewarding those who read instead of criticizing the ones who don't. So I thought that was interesting.
And it is something you could quite easily replicate. Presumably, if you're spotted reading a book on the Lewis or on the Dart or the train or wherever you are in Ireland, you know, if you're reading something, somebody approaches you, gives you a free voucher for a travel ticket, something like that.
I assume so. It's an interesting one. I'm not sure if it would have legs here. I would love if it did. Who knows? Let's watch this space.
Something for free in Ireland. It may be a bit of wishful thinking, mightn't it?
One of the other things, I suppose, that has caught the attention in the book world, and this is maybe a bit sideways in the book world, but it's the work practices at Amazon. What have you thought of this, Bob?
Yeah, it was a New York Times article that came out August the 15th by Jody Cantor and David Streetfield. It caused a lot of consternation in the US. Obviously, it's being talked about over here as well. Last year, there was a lot of talk about what it was like to work in an Amazon warehouse where you were forced to walk miles and miles every single day with hardly any breaks and with a monitor on your arm that everybody knew when you went to the toilet or stopped for 2 seconds. This one's more about the blue collar workers, as I say, or the people working in the offices, the people doing the buying and the selling, working for them. And by all accounts, it's a pretty scary place to work. You know, the pressure is huge. The accounts that were in the New York Times interview about the workplaces that employees are pitted against each other, encouraged to make complaints online about each other, and those can actually be put then into your formal review by your line manager. There were discussions in the article about one lady who had to take some time off to care for her father who had cancer. When she came back, she was put on a performance review because she wasn't spending enough time on her job, and it went on there. She resigned shortly afterwards, I believe. And very similar type incidents to this, another lady who had a miscarriage and lost her baby, again returned to work to find that she had been badly rated and had to go on a performance review package, and again left the company very shortly afterwards. So in fairness, this is a kind of company where the idea is everybody becomes a component. The customer is king. We will do anything it takes to get that product to the customer in the best way. But should companies treat their employees simply as another algorithm to be played with?
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose we shouldn't really... I don't think many people were surprised by this. The New York Times piece was really meaty. It was 6,500 words, and I think there was 100-plus interviews carried out. So there was clearly it wasn't based on absolutely nothing. Some of the interesting things that jumped out. Emails arrived past midnight, followed by text messages asking why they were not answered, which gives another meaning to the phrase sleepless in Seattle, I guess. Employees say that the internal phone directory instructs colleagues on how to send secret feedback to their bosses, and that's frequently used to sabotage others. And the tool offers sample text, including this: I felt concerned about his inflexibility and openly complaining about minor tasks, which is put forward as a sample for one employee to complain about another employee. It's one former Amazon employee said, nearly every person I worked with I saw cry at their desk. I guess like that's we shouldn't be really surprised when a massive tech company takes things to the extremes in the interests of efficiency. But certainly it's not a place that I think I would relish working.
No, I mean I've worked for some bad companies in my time, but I don't think I've ever been subjected to anything like that. And you do have to ask, you know, what position do we come in where people become just another component in a machine that churns out to make, you know, Jeff Bezos the most, you know, I think they're turning into a trillion, billion, dillion, whatever dollar business in the US this year. At what cost?
It also takes things like, I don't think even George Orwell would have foreseen. It goes way beyond anything in 1984.
My favorite line that stood out was, obviously they have a high burnout factor, and a lot of those people go off to try and work for other people, and apparently in the industry they're termed amholes,
because they're
so pugnacious and work obsessed that they can't see beyond the lines anymore because it's been drummed out of them. God love them.
Yeah, the 14 principles are interesting, I guess. Like, they're, when you read them through them, it's find it hard to disagree with them. They're quite nice, but they're also suitably vague that they allow everybody to the workforce, which is skewed young and male and alpha male, I guess. Yeah. It allows them to do whatever they want, I guess, in the sake of furthering what they're about. So
there we go. So that's our news roundup for this month. Moving on, as every book-related thing should have, here at Bookish, we are going to be holding a book club, and we invite you to read with us and join in the discussion. Over the next month, we'll be reading Anne Enright's The Green Road, Man Booker long-listed Irish writer, and Shane and myself will be back next month to discuss what we made of it.
Join us in a second. We'll be back with Trilogy, which is our guest slot, and we'll be talking to Arlene Hunt, one of Ireland's leading crime writers, about the three books that were influential in her life and career.
Our next feature is a guest slot called Trilogy, where we invite a guest in to talk about three books that particularly either influenced them, they particularly enjoyed, or in some way inspired them. And for our very first show, we're delighted to welcome crime writer Arlene Hunt, author of 8 crime novels, I believe, the latest being The Chosen, published by Portnoy Publishing in 2013. You're very welcome, Arlene.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me.
And you come bearing gifts of three books for us.
I do. I have The Choir Boys, which is, I think, was first published in 1975 by Joseph Wamba. Then I have the very much widely loved All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot, which I'm a huge, huge fan of, and I'll explain now in a moment why. And then the last book I had was, what was my last book?
Some experiences of an Irish RM.
And I'll tell you why I forgot the, I just keep thinking of the TV show The Irish RM, so I can actually forget about the entire the book title, even though it took me over a year to find this particular book. So those are my three books.
Okay, and why have you chosen?
Well, I've been thinking about this, and what I realised between last night and today is that in all of the books there's a certain amount of displacement. And I hadn't really thought about it before. So, you know, in, say, All Creatures Great and Small, you know, Harriet goes to the
I know that doesn't the oddest book for a crime writer to choose as one of their favourite picks.
It is. It's purely to do with childhood, I think, because I spent a lot of my childhood out in the wilds with just as a dog. It's not that actually that different from my life now, but I spent a lot of time out in the wilds with just a dog as a companion. And I just found his stories to be absolutely side-splittingly hilarious. You know, he's so... has no idea, you know, the life he's dropped into in the Yorkshire Dales with real Yorkshiremen and farm men, and he's trying his best to, you know, be the vet that he hopes he'll be, and he's just derided and mocked. And
it's one of those series of books that I never actually read that were always recommended, you know, as great reads you must do, and everybody obviously remembers the TV series, which was one of those big 1980s.
Huge. It was a Sunday evening sort of TV show.
It was the Sunday evening viewing, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they were very lucky because the three actors they had for the show, for Siegfried, for Tristan, and for James, they really gelled well on screen. They fed off each other brilliantly, and it was almost as bonkers on screen as it is in the books. And the books are really, really funny. And I read them again in Barcelona a few years ago, and I had to stop reading them on the metro because I'd sort of be travelling along quietly and everyone's sort of reading the paper, and I just start laughing really loudly and like I had to stop doing because it was making people really nervous. They're that funny, you know, but they're also terribly poignant. There's some wonderful scenes in it, and that's one of the things I really love about them. I mean, these are hardened men a lot of the times that he works with. It's after the war. They're bordering on the breadline. They don't have a lot. Like this, you're talking about Yorkshire. It's not really of its time. It's not really flush with cash, and you know the people aren't sympathetic, or they don't treat animals as pets. They don't treat them as, you know, anything other than, you know, how to make a livelihood and how to just scrape by.
And are they dated in any way? Do you find them kind
no,
of
that's
out
the
of
weird.
Date?
No, yeah. That's the weird thing about it. So you've got all these like strange scenes in it where, you know, like I said, you have these kind of hardened guys, but then you up the back haggard that like have a horse that's 28 years of age and doesn't do anything around and just is eating fuel basically but they won't let go of them, and it's really touching that way. There's loads of these really amazing touching scenes. I'd say if you got someone nowadays from the city and dropped them into the middle of Yorkshire and said, listen, get on with it, it would be just as relevant today.
Yeah.
You know, that the blow-in aspect of it and trying to fit in into a kind of rural community, it's just, it's really brilliant.
And you say that's the thing you've realised really appealed to you, is this kind of the idea of, you know, people being out of place and out of...
Yeah, because my last book was The Irish RM, and people, again, remember the TV series more than they would have read the book. And the TV series, you know, had the great Peter Bowles. He was marvellous in the role, and it had, you know, the I can't remember the name of the actor. He played Flory Knox. He was in Brookside as well. Irish actor.
Brian Murray.
Thank
there you.
You
that was a good whisper.
Thank
from
you.
Above.
Precise whisper. So he was Flory Knox, and again, so this is an English magistrate coming over to the Irish, the very rural Irish countryside. I mean, dropped into this sort of locale where everyone knows each other, and you know, initially you think, well, he's going to have highfalutin ideas and he's going to be this, but actually they just run rings around him, and it's really, really funny as he tries to fit in and tries to work out what the hell is going on. And he, you know, at every step, he's you know, bedeviled and dogged, and he can't really work out the structure, the village structure, the local structure. How does he fit in? And then he gets married, and she comes over, and she's very, very ladylike, and she's down in, you know, putting out pots and pans, trying to catch the and horses are stolen. Everyone's always drunk or fighting. It's brilliant. It's really entertaining, though. It's a really entertaining look again at somebody who's coming from a completely different life and dropped straight into the middle of a, you know, an already set piece and trying to figure it out.
I'm seeing a lot of humour in your picks as well, Arlene.
There is, yeah.
You like books that make you laugh.
I do. I think it's because I write a lot of dark subjects a lot of the time, and my books aren't necessarily humour, so that when I have a bit of a downtime, I quite like to read books that at least
something
sort of tickle my funny
of,
bone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Is there something, Arlene, about the author Somerville and Ross that did they mean much to you when you were in your formative years? And I suppose the reason I bring it up is that they're a little bit in vogue again. This in the next month or so, the new The Long Gay Is Back, edited by Sinead Gleeson, has been published by New Ireland
That's right,
Press.
Yeah.
Collection of Irish
women
writing, for the great cover for that from the last 100 years or so. And there is one of the stories with Somerville and Ross are in there. And what was there anything about them in particular that meant much to you when you were reading?
I didn't even know that they were in that, because I haven't read the anthology yet. I'm actually looking forward to getting my filthy paws on it, but I haven't read it yet. But that doesn't surprise me, that because when they write about Ireland of that era, it's really funny, but it's really genuine. Like you can sort of see. It's kind of, it's humour in a velvet glove, you know. I mean, it's very pointed and sometimes about how, you know, you just don't fit in. But actually, it's quite handily done, very funny the way they do it. But you know, again, it's that whole sense of being not part of a community, and that's why if I'm gonna just bring it over to The Choir Boys, which is totally different. The Choir Boys is written by an ex LA police officer, Joseph Wamba, and. The reason I chose The Choir Boys is very simply, it was the first time I'd ever read a book, an adult book. It was probably my first proper adult book, and I read it far too young. I shouldn't have been reading that book at the age I read it, and that's being very honest. I'd gone from reading, you know, Edith Blyton and The Famous Five and The Secret Seven and, you know, The Valley Girls. All those were the books I had read previous to picking up The Choir Boys. So to give you an idea of what The Choir Boys is about, it's about 10... LA police officers of varying ages and rank who are very much us and them. You know, they're of their time as well. They're racist, they're sexist, they're thieves, they're blackguards, they're everything you don't want a person to be, they are. But they have formed a community amongst themselves. So what The Choir Boys was, it was the choir session was where they would go to MacArthur Park and just kick back and talk and drink and get up to mischief and just be stupid and almost turn into boys again, you know, and just to blow off the steam of the job. The job is is almost incidental to the camaraderie of these men. But then it absolutely blew me away, because it's the first time I'd ever read anything that reveals so much about humanity and about people and about how vile and vicious life can be. You know, when you're going from Enid Blyton, the worst thing that happens is if, you know, Julie and Dick and Anne, George and Timmy the dog, don't get ginger pop. It's not
mild
the end of the
peril,
world.
I believe
yeah,
they
mild
call it
peril.
Mild peril.
Oh, we've been locked into a room. Quickly, push the key out onto a page and pull it back. But when I read The Choir Boys, it was like murder, mayhem, rape, children being abused, savagery, the fallout of what happens to veterans from Vietnam, the terror, and the fact that they're, when they come back from Nam, they're just basically thrown to the wolves and no one gave them any support or anything. It's just like, it blew my mind. I think I was only 12 when I read it.
I was going to say what age actually
12.
Were you?
12.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, I think I was 12. So it was, I remember reading it, and I didn't get all of the references in it because I was too young, but I remember being absolutely fascinated by it and rereading it a number of times throughout my life and picking up something else from it.
Was it something that you sucked off your parents' shelves, or how did you get your hands on it at that age?
My father, he used to go to this pub called Finns of Cunnery, which is a really, really, really remote pub in between Red Cross and Avoca. It was up in the middle of nowhere. And the lady who was in charge of it, she's one of the few people that could ever handle him. He was a funny man, but he was an ex-army guy as well, and he liked to drink. And he could be a bit of a handful when he had a few scoops on him. But he went up there and he was the most respectful person you ever met. She just was able to kind of keep a tight rein on him. And she used to give him bags and bags of books. He used to be the old Reader's Digests, the old the little copies, the little tiny ones you'd always find in the dentist years ago. And, you know, there'd be various different novels thrown out, and he'd bring it back down in this big black sack, and I used to dive straight in and get whatever I could get. And that's where the first copy of The Choir Boys came out.
And is it something, because as Bob mentioned earlier on, that when you see the three books that you brought to us today, it was when I read through and I said, yeah, The Choir Boys, Joseph Wambo, yeah, that's while I mightn't have expected that one in particular, it is something that is in keeping with your status as a crime writer, and the other two were completely out of left field, I think. But what was it about maybe The Choir Boys or Wamba in particular? When you have you, and presumably you might have reread it at some point in later life, what was it about that in particular that can really stands out from a crime, maybe as a practitioner of crime?
It's just so authentic. It's completely authentic. The dialogue is authentic. The emotional content is authentic. And you can tell, like, I wasn't surprised when I looked Wamba up and found out that he'd been on the streets himself as a police officer for years. It absolutely was no surprise to me whatsoever, because quite clearly when he wrote about these men, he had a huge affection for them, but he also had a huge understanding of the stresses and strain they're under their job. And also how not all of them are particularly nice. There's one called Roscoe Rules. He's famous as just being the biggest jerk you're ever likely going to meet. He's just one of the worst people you'll ever meet. You know, he's just, there's a running joke with the men, you know, that he gave out towels at Auschwitz. That's the kind of guy you're dealing with. But even so, when Roscoe gets into a fight, they all have his back, because he is one of the member of the Choir Boys. So this kind of camaraderie, and it stems from them all being in the army as well, you know, where you don't leave a man behind. So when they get to the streets, and as policemen, you know, we can look at even now in the States, you know, the kind of militarized style of the police, and how there is still that mentality of us versus them. And this was the first time I'd ever seen it in print. It's very much that. And when those guys put on the uniform and get into the squad cars, that's it. They are they, and everyone else is other. And it was just really interesting to read that. Even as a 12-year-old, I could see that was like something else, and I'd have to study it again and again.
It's very much an ensemble piece as well, isn't it? And that's maybe what struck me as being something that's maybe slightly different than the crime genre, where in a lot of cases you have maybe it's very much from one law officer's perspective or point of view, whereas this seems to be very, very different in that regard.
Yeah, he handles it as a community. He handles all of the men. The men come and they rise and they fall as one. And that's pretty obvious in the book as well. And it's just one of the things that I really found and have always found fascinating about Wamba when he writes like that, because a lot of his books are about a collaboration of people and not just about one unique individual.
So there we have Arlene Hunt and her three picks for our first trilogy feature. The books chosen, The Choir Boys by Joseph Wamba, All Creatures Great and Small by James Herriot, and Some Experiences of an Irish RM by E. Somerville and Martin Ross. Thank you so much for coming and joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Second look is the part of Bookish where we consider a book we think may have been overlooked first time round. Developments in the technology of publishing means there are more publishers than ever before, publishing more books than ever before. One estimate suggests there's almost 200,000 books published in the UK and Ireland every single year. With so much choice, it's inevitable that really good books will be swept away. So each month we'll be selecting one book that has undeservedly fallen off the radar. And my first choice this month is a book called Keeper, written by Mal Peet and published by Walker Books in 2003. It's a book that was ostensibly written for YA or middle grade or 10-year-old plus, whatever the label might be. But like all the best books of that ilk, it deserves a much wider audience. It won an award called the Branford Bowes Award in 2004, which is an award that pays tribute to the relationship between writer and editor. So it's not just for the book, it's for the editing process that goes into it as well. And it's been reprinted several times since then, but I think it's fair to say it's definitely not remembered as a classic, and it possibly deserves to be. The story revolves around two main characters. The chief character, the first person we come to, is a sports writer called Paul Faustino, and he's interviewing a goalkeeper called El Gato. It doesn't say which country El Gato is from, but I think we can surmise that it's probably Brazil. And it's in the days after El Gato has helped his country win the World Cup. Now, in the Venn diagrams of prospective audiences, I think that I am possibly in a tiny little perfect subset for that. I do love sports books. I do love sport. I do love the World Cup. I become a bit of a child at every 4 years when the World Cup comes along. I do play football and I am also a goalkeeper, so it's definitely a perfect book for me. But I think when you cast your eyes over lists of great sports books or the internet for best sports books, very many times 90%, 95%, maybe 100% of those in some cases will be non-fiction books. And I think sport is a really, really hard thing to fictionalize. But I think that Mal Peet has did a wonderful, wonderful job with this book, Keeper. If you're a student of writing, it really stands up to close scrutiny. It's a really fantastic, structurally it's fantastic. The story evolves during the course of an interview, which lasts several hours over a night time, between late at night to the following morning, between the two main characters in a high-rise office block over the city of possibly Rio. It's an unnamed city. It outlines the previously untold story of El Gato's childhood and how he learned the art of goalkeeping over an extended period of time. His coach was the enigmatic keeper of the title, and his training field was an equally mysterious clearing in the middle of the Amazonian jungle. All the best books have some element of magic, and the magic is definitely present in Keeper as well. It really is an excellent read when you get to the start. When you get to the end of it, I just wanted to start it right over again. If you're a student of sport and goalkeeping, it hits the mark. If you just want a good story, this is the book for you. You don't need an interest in goalkeeper or football or sport, but I think it probably helps. And one of the things when I was reading it or rereading it again recently, it struck me that this could be the perfect book for maybe the sports mad teenager who's maybe distanced themselves from reading, and I think this one could really get them back into it. Drawing attention to Keeper at this stage is maybe a little poignant. Mal Peet died earlier this year. Keeper was his first novel. It was published when he was 56, and he published several books after that. Keeper was also the first of a loose trilogy starring Paul Faustino, and it comes really highly recommended from me. I've been pressing it into the hands of people in the shop, and they've been enjoying it as much as I do, and I think it would be great to see this get a wider audience.
So that's our second look pick for this month, and moving on from looking backwards to looking forward. So new books on their way out that have caught our eye this month. Shane, what's first up for you this month?
Well, first one up is at the end of September, the new book by Donal Ryan, Slanting of the Sun. It's his first book of short stories. It follows in the footsteps of his two novels published a couple of years ago, The Thing About December and The Spinning Heart. Spinning Heart was the first of those. It is, I suppose, that Donal Ryan has become really, I've been thinking about this recently, and it feels like he's become the voice of rural Ireland as much as Roddy Doyle became the voice of Dublin 20 odd years ago. And I'm really looking forward to this. I think it's I've read a couple of them already. It's not out until the 29th of September, but I've read a couple of them, and they're definitely for fans of the thing about December and the Spinning Heart. I think they're going to get plenty in this that they're going to like as well.
Yeah, certainly one I'm looking forward to. I'm a big Donal Ryan fan as well. First one to catch my eye this month is the new Jonathan Franzen novel, Purity, due out 1st of September, so pretty much on the shelves as we speak. Jonathan Franzen is obviously known for The Corrections and the book Freedom. Now, The Corrections I adored. It was the book that they wanted to put on the Oprah book show, but he refused to let them put it into their book club, which caused much scandal at the time and all kinds of stories of him being a snob and et cetera, et cetera. Apparently they've made it all up now. Freedom, I must admit, has its fans out there. Didn't do much for me. I found it a bit long and tedious and really didn't capture me at all. But this one does sound good. Purity is about Pip Tyler, who doesn't know who she is. She's got $130,000 in student debt. She's squatting with anarchists in Oakland, and her relationship with her mother is somewhat hazardous. So I think we're back onto familiar Jonathan Franzen territory of dysfunctional relationships all round for everyone. I do like his writing. He is coming over to Dublin, I believe, Monday the 5th of October. Tickets are available for that at ilfdublin.com. I am looking forward to going to that. I think it'll be very interesting. He's never far from the news. I think, again, he was out there this week saying that anybody who was on Twitter was wasting their life or something, but that's par for the course for Jonathan Franzen, I think.
Absolutely, and Franzen the person, I think, really, in a lot of ways, rubs people up the wrong way, but Franzen the writer, I'm a big fan, and I'm maybe the opposite of you, Bob. I've really, really adored Freedom. I think the first 25, 30 pages of Freedom are as good a passage as you could hope to read, I think. And I think for students of writing, they could do a lot worse than rereading that.
I think you might just be a
that.
Bit brainier than me, Shane. That's what it is.
I don't know about that, Bob. Moving on to my second pick this month, and it's on the shelves now. It was launched in Bob's Gutter Bookshop on Friday the 27th of August, I believe. And it's Miss Emily by Nuala O'Connor. I think this may be the first book that has Nuala O'Connor written in that format.
That's right.
She has been going under the name Nuala Nuchrahur up to this point, but I think that certainly that this one is aiming at a wider English and American audience, certainly. And I think it's obviously a strategic decision to put Nuala O'Connor on the cover. Miss Emily, it concerns the relationship between Emily Dickinson and her Irish maid Ada Concannon in 1860s Massachusetts. I'm reading it currently. I'm absolutely loving it, and it's highly recommended to everybody.
Very good. Yeah, I've not even had a chance to look at it yet, but again, it's on my tottering pile of things I must get to soon. The non-fiction pickup for me this month actually is the collected articles of Roisin Ingall from the Irish Times. It's called Public Displays of Emotion, and it's out on the 10th of December. Oh, sorry, 10th of September from Irish Times Books. I love Roisin Ingall. Oh, sorry, it's one of those, it's the highlight of the week reading Roisin Ingall's columns. She's funny, she's clever, she gets people. Now, this is a collection of columns, so I'm sure I've read some of them before, but I think she's even said herself when she was collating them together, there's so many of them you forget. And so it's just going to be one of those nice, interesting books, good insights into Irish life and into Irish families, and just in general, just a good laugh, I think. So Public Displays of Emotion from Roisin Ingall is kind of my non-fiction pick for the month.
She's one of those also that Jonathan Franzen think is wasting her life on Twitter. She's active on Twitter,
like,
and very influential. Very influential on Twitter. A retweet from Roisin Ingall goes a long way. The next one maybe that caught my eye this month is a book called Grief is the Thing with Feathers by Max Porter, which is out on September 19th. It's a really short book. I haven't read anything of it. I think it's about 120 pages. I've heard lots of whispers about how good this is. I think it's part memoir, part study of grief, part novella. I don't know what it is, but it's got a lot of attention, and it's been popping up in my Twitter feeds and various things. So I'm really looking forward to picking that up in mid-September.
Up next for me, We Don't Know What We're Doing by Tom Morris, which rings all kinds of bells at the minute. Thomas Morris is the official name on the title. We all know him as Tom Morris, editor at the Stinging Fly Press in Dublin. But Tom Morris is a writer as well. This is his new collection of short stories. He's from Wales. They're mainly based in Wales. I believe there's some sojourns over to Dublin as part of it. Irish short story writing is always wonderful anyway. From the ones I read of this collection already, he's a talented young writer and certainly one to watch. So We Don't Know What We're Doing by Thomas Morris, and that's out now.
And another thing on that, and I guess it's the pervasive influence of Twitter. I remember seeing Tom tweet the cover in its iterative process, and it really helped. That was over the last 6 months or so, and it really helped to get a little bit of conversation going about the book before it ever landed on shelves. So that was an interesting element of that. If I wrap up with my new book picks for this month, just with a couple of anthologies, Irish anthologies that are out this month. Windharp, which is published by Penguin on the 3rd of September, is a collection of Irish poetry since 1916. So I think it's a clever idea. It's edited by Niall McMonagall. It takes us from Yeats, Easter 1916, right through to the present day. All the great Irish poets of the last century are there, and that's an interesting one. I think it's a beautiful book, really nicely put together as well. The Long Gaze Back, New Ireland collection, edited by Sinead Gleeson, which we've mentioned already earlier in the show. It's a collection of short stories by Irish women writers, ranging from greats of the past, such as Mary Lavin, Somerville and Ross, to unpublished or new stories by the contemporary greats now. And a Kind of Compass, which is the latest book by Tramp Press. Lisa Cohen and Sarah Davis Goff, really making strides over the last couple of years. Small independent publisher, and I'm really keeping an eye on everything they're doing. And their next book is A Kind of Compass. It's a collection of short stories on the theme of distance, and it's edited by the excellent Belinda McKeown, and that's out on September 17th.
Wonderful. And my final couple of picks for this month, A Place Called Winter by Patrick Gow is just hitting shops in paperback format. One of the best books I read in hardback earlier in the year. It's about what it's like to be gay and a farmer in the American prairies, but just such beautiful writing, just a stunning novel. And then coming up on the 24th of September, the surprise announcement last week, List of the Lost, the first novel from Morrissey. So whether it's going to be any good or not, I don't know, but it's got to be in there as a pick for September. So that's our new picks for this month. And coming up after this short break, we'll be talking about our final sort of events and things going on around Ireland.
That's just about it for the very first episode of Bookish. Thank you to everybody for tuning in. If you tune into a podcast, I'm not sure if you do. We're gonna wrap up with just a few mentions of different things that are going on around the country during September. Culture Night obviously has become quite a big annual occurrence now. There's loads of events. I'm sure if you just visit the Culture Night website, you'll get all everything that's going on around the country. We have in Blackbird Books in Navan, we have what we're calling a micless open mic. So we don't have a mic, but our shop is really tiny, so we don't need it. So that's going on. Anyone who wants to come along and just read their own or other people's work, that's fantastic. So Culture Night, September the 18th.
That's it. And in the Gutter Bookshop for Culture Night, we're actually doing music this year. We've done open mics before, and they're always great fun. We decided to do some music this year. So we've got some music performances by the Royal Irish Academy of Music scattered through the evening. So I'm expecting much noise, let's put it like that.
Fantastic. The CBI conference, the Children's Book Ireland conference, is on September 12th and 13th. And there's a really excellent lineup of speakers and various things going on over 2 days there. So check out the CBI website for that. Other things going on, again bringing it back I suppose to Blackbird, I'm getting a bit selfish, but we have our very first bookshop gig, which has just been confirmed over the last couple of days. It is into October. It's the first weekend of October, October 3rd, so I'm just giving an early mention of that. I suppose in a lot of ways, Bob, and you'd probably concur with this, the internet is regarded as the enemy of bookshops, but in this instance we got an email from a music promoter in New York. So in this instance, the internet has been the friend.
Oh, yeah. No, the internet is our friend as well. It's amazing how many people get in touch with you wanting to do things in your bookshops when you're on Twitter and the web. From us, Electric Picnic, 5th and 6th of September. You wouldn't think there would be a place for a bookshop in Electric Picnic, but there is. There's an Arts Council tent down in Mindfield. So if you're heading down to Electric Picnic, pop in and see us. There's book talks throughout the weekend. Lineup includes Colin McCann, John Banville, Sinead Gleeson, Mary Costello, Tom McCarthy, Roddy Doyle, Owen Colfer, Viv Albertine, the musician whose autobiography is out. We're down there with the Gutter Bookshop standing in the middle of the field with lots of drunk people asking me why there's books in the middle of a field. So that's always good fun. We'll also be at the CBI conference down at the Lighthouse Cinema that you've already mentioned, Culture Night. And then we'll also be at the Dublin Festival of History, which is, I think, it's the third year this year, Friday the 25th to Sunday the 20th of September at Dublin Castle. It's actually always a really good, interesting festival if you're into history at all. Guests this year including Tom Holland, Stella Tillyard, Andrew Roberts and Peter Snow. So plenty going on, I think, in the bookish world for September. So again, thank you all for tuning in and listening to us ramble on about books at Bookish this month. If you want to speak to me, I'm on at Gutter Bookshop on Twitter. And Shane?
We are at BlackbirdBKS, and there's going to be lots more information on the website at castaway.media/bookish. That's castaway.media/bookish.
This was a Castaway Media production. Find us on Twitter at Castaway Media or on Facebook, facebook.com/Castaway Podcasts.